This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, the founder of the Iraq Oil Report, Kalamazoo native and Western Michigan University graduate Ben Lando, along with the report's Baghdad bureau chief, discuss the conditions in Iraq and what the future may hold in that country. But first, it's been widely reported over the years that black babies born in Kalamazoo County die in the first year of life at disproportionately higher rates than whites. WMUK's Erlene McMichael has more on the latest efforts to address that problem.
Joining us to talk about a new initiative being launched on November 21st are Grace Lumbwama, the new CEO of the YWCA of Kalamazoo, and Deborah Davenport, Director of the Office of Community Health Services in the Los Angeles Department of Public Health in Los Angeles, California. Lumbwama is in the Kalamazoo studios of WMUK, and Davenport is joining us by phone. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Davenport and Lumbwama worked together on an initiative in Los Angeles that was successful in significantly dropping the black infant mortality rate there. Let's talk about the term black infant mortality. What does that actually mean?
When we talk about the infant mortality rate, what we are talking about is the number of births of children that are dying before their first birthday. And this is out of 1,000 births. That's what we are talking about. And then when we talk about the infant mortality rate between the white babies and the black babies, you know, then we are talking about the difference in the two races. And if all the children are receiving the same services and in the same community, same resources, there should not be a gap between babies, whatever color, the rate should be the same.
What is the scope of the problem here in Kalamazoo County in terms of numbers? In a nutshell, what is the issue here?
And I'm new to Kalamazoo. I've only been here 9 months. And just looking at the indicators of health, when you come into a community, you look at what is the well-being of the community. And there are things that you look at that show you the well-being of the community. Infant mortality rate is one of the indicators of the well-being of the community. So when I looked at that and saw the disparities between the white babies and the black babies, it's such a huge gap. You know, for 2013 data, the infant mortality amongst white babies in Kalamazoo was around 3.9. And within the African-American babies, it went as high as 21 point some. So there is a huge gap for babies who are receiving the same services. So that's the magnitude we have here in Kalamazoo. Just to put it in simple terms, what that number means is that the rate at which black babies are dying is five times than the rate at which white babies are dying.
What does the research tend to say as to what are the factors that lead to a high rate of black infant mortality?
Well, most of the research points to the fact that you can't look at factors like age or income or education for African-American infant mortality because it tends to reach across all of those areas. And it really gets down to issues of preconception health. So what is the health status of the mother going into the pregnancy? And what are the psychosocial factors around that woman that really help determine the outcomes of that birth?
Now, that's probably a good jumping off point to talk about what was going on in Los Angeles. What was fascinating to me is you actually interviewed some of the women who had lost their children. Tell me the process that you all used in Los Angeles.
Well, we have a division in our department called the Maternal Child and Adolescent Health Unit, and it's among the other services that they manage is a huge data unit that goes in and does an analysis of birth outcomes, and they do several different studies. The primary one is called the Fetal Infant Mortality Review, which really goes back and looks at the data around the pregnancy and the delivery and outcomes afterwards. Around these infant deaths in the first year of life. Then the other thing that was done was the LA Mom and Baby Survey, which really actually interviews the moms about what happened during that period so they can get a better idea of maybe some of the psychosocial factors that were impacting things as well. So what we decided to do, since the rates were so high in the Antelope Valley, and this is back in the early 2000s, the rate went up to 32.7 at one point per 1,000 live births. Pretty alarming, and I can see why Kalamazoo is concerned as well. We actually did face-to-face interviews with those mothers, and we really found there was a huge component, not only physical, but also psychosocial, to their ability to manage their health both before, during, and after the pregnancy.
What were some of the contributing factors? For example, my understanding is that they were not able to get access to prenatal care and that transportation was an issue, that there was a great distance in order to get that care.
Yeah, the Antelope Valley is actually a high desert community up in the up northern region of Los Angeles County, which is 4,400 square miles. So it's a pretty big area. And the Antelope Valley is fairly remote behind another big mountain range here in L.A. So getting to services is not easy if you want to come into the L.A. Basin. There are medical services up in the valley and a hospital for delivery. There's now two there. The issue, though, was the ability to access high-risk prenatal care. And really how well they were able to access their ongoing medical care, because a lot of these women had pre-existing medical conditions. Some of them had other issues going on in their life as well, no social support. The issue of transportation is a big one up there because it's such a broad open area, and getting around between the two towns of Lancaster and Palmdale was difficult given the bus system at the time. I'm happy to say since then things have changed markedly up there.
I should probably take a moment to say that, Ms. Lumbwama, that you were the executive director of the Antelope Valley Partners for Health in Antelope Valley in California, which actually helped spearhead the effort that was done in California. Can you tell me the name of that initiative and what exactly all did it involve?
The initiative was called the Antelope Valley Best Babies Collaborative. And coming into that community, I was probably new in that community as well as I am in Kalamazoo. And working with Debbie, who was the public health officer then in that community, really providing that consistency and leadership of convening the community, really having that grassroots effort to address an issue that was happening in the community. And I think that leadership within the Antelope Valley Partners for Health as an executive director gave me the opportunity to leverage and start that conversation in the community. And we formed a collaborative, which is still existing, that is really looking to improve birth outcomes in that community.
So essentially, you brought lots of people mm-hmm. to the table, mm-hmm. you gathered the data, you interviewed women to find out who had lost their children, to find out what were some of the factors that contributed to that, and that shaped what it is that you all ultimately did. I think the faith-based community was mm-hmm. involved mm-hmm. as well.
I'll point out a couple of things that were key to making this effort successful and making the collaborative successful in the Antelope Valley. One of the things was really coordinating the different services we had. You know, we had all the different programs, the nurse family practitioner program, the home visiting program, we had the Black Infant Health program. There were a couple of organizations that were doing work in that community, but each one of us was doing work fragmentedly. So the Antelope Valley Partners for Health came together and gave an opportunity for all different players in the community to come together and address the issue. So really coordinating those services was key. But not only, when we talk about infant mortality, it's a very complex issue. So we wanted to make sure that the community voice was involved. You know, churches were involved. The faith-based component was really, really key, engaging those churches into being part of that collaborative and creating a community that welcomed every birth that we had in the Antelope Valley.
In terms of what you hope to do here in Kalamazoo, on November 21st, you are having a gathering. You have a number of partners who are joining you in that effort, all the way from both of the hospitals, Borges and Bronson, the county, the Western Michigan University School of Medicine. What is this coalition and what exactly are you going to do?
This is the beginning, the kickoff of let us as a community look at infant mortality as an issue, especially looking at the disparities in our community, remembering that infant mortality is a key indicator of how well we're doing in this community. The key players that you've talked about definitely are the key in terms of healthcare providing in this community with the medical school, but other partners are going to be coming at that table also and having that conversation. You see some members of the churches being there, even just community residents that are passionate about this issue will be key players at that day. So that will give us kind of first phase one. And then phase two is really gather and have an intentional strategy of how we are going to deal with this issue.
My understanding also, Ms. Lumbuama, is that the Y will be, at least in the Kalamazoo community, serving as kind of the nucleus for this collaboration because of your experience in that background.
Mm-hmm, and that is correct. The YWCA will kind of be the lead convener for this conversation. We will provide the consistency. We'll provide the accountability. And also part of that, you know, when you look at the data, we see women who have been abused. 80% of the women that come to us are pregnant. And because this is an issue that really affects women, the YWCA, which is one of the lead agencies here in Kalamazoo that is really looking at empowering women and looking at women's issues, we are going to be at the forefront of leading this initiative and being that backbone agency.
Are you anticipating that this will require funding?
You know, Kalamazoo is such a rich community. We have so many resources. You know, actually, the resources that we have here in Kalamazoo, we didn't have in Los Angeles. So the first thing we're going to do is let us coordinate what we already have. So I think once we do that analysis of what is our current landscape and really analyze our current landscape, then we can talk about funding. But I think we do have the resources here.
Two main areas that can affect Black infant mortality. There's a little chart that you've kind of supplied here. One of them is poverty and what comes out of that, and the other one is racism and discrimination. Ms. Davenport, feel free to jump in on that.
Well, I think it really gets down to, very personally, when we interviewed women about their level of self-esteem. And so some of the programs that we work with, like the state's Black Infant Health Program, were really about not just doing case management around their access to medical care, any medical problems they or their children had, or any other resources that they need, but also doing some empowerment of these women to really take charge of their health and their, you know, their futures and the futures of their children and become actively involved in it. And the program, the Black Infant Health Program, actually has a strong component in it of doing social empowerment for women in the African-American community. So I think it was something they could really identify with, and that program served as the basis for a lot of what we did. And I think it's very important in these instances where, you know, there are these racial disparities.
I'm thinking, for example, when you think about racism, perhaps, again, looking at this chart that I was given, it talks about that that can add more stress in the life of the mother and so therefore could affect the pregnancy.
Absolutely.
Data has come out and research has come out now that women who are Black, because of the stress within the systematic kind of systems that we have, they're at high risk of infant mortality. So there are more deeper things that we need to have conversation around the systems and how racism plays a role in part of this also.
Ms. Davenport, is there anything you want to add to that?
There's two primary areas when you approach this problem. One is around maternal health, including prematurity. So it really gets into the care of the woman, not only when she's pregnant, but also before she becomes pregnant. Because if there's pre-existing health problems, that's going to really increase stress on the woman when she becomes pregnant. And then for the babies, it really gets down to issues if the woman is having a hard time coping and making ends meet and can't get things together. You know, you can develop more safety issues, health issues. She may not be able to breastfeed, which we know is really important in the early life of infants, and that there may be family and parenting issues that come out of this as well. So it's that whole cycle of someone's family life, not only when they're pregnant, but also before they become pregnant, that really impacts these stressors in their life and ultimately the stressors on their children. So it's very important to address the whole environment of the family as a whole.
Is there anything that either of you would like to offer to the conversation that I've not asked?
Well, I'd just like to say that, you know, the community groundswell for what we did in the Antelope Valley, I think was really part of the success. Even my public health nurses wanted to pitch in into programs we aren't really part of on a normal routine basis and help do home evaluations on moms to enable community health workers that might be new to doing this to help them succeed at what they were doing. This was a real community effort, even to the point of people in the churches saying, you know, that they were going to just start a process of greeting pregnant women and ask them how they're feeling. Are they in prenatal care? Those kind of basic messages that they can do in a friendly manner that lets women know that they're important and their community cares about them. We even did community baby showers.
And I think what a great opportunity for Kalamazoo to celebrate the birth of every child in this community. You know, I've been talking about going back to the instance of having a village so that we celebrate every child. You know, we are so fortunate that we have the Kalamazoo Promise. You know, as we want these children to excel and graduate and go out to college, let us celebrate their first birthday.
Well, Ms. Davenport and Ms. Limbuama, thank you so much for your time and great success on the effort.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good luck.
For West Southwest, I'm Earlene McMichael.
The kickoff meeting for the Kalamazoo Infant Mortality Community Action Initiative will be held tomorrow morning from 9 o'clock until 11:30 at the Western Michigan University Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine in downtown Kalamazoo. It's open to the public. YWCA of Kalamazoo CEO Grace Limbuama will discuss the issue and will be joined by video conference by three of her colleagues on the California Black Infant Mortality Initiative, including Deborah Davenport, who was interviewed along with Limbuama. More details and a longer version of this interview can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. In recent years, our audience has often heard from Ben Lando, the Kalamazoo native, Western Michigan University graduate, and founder of the Iraq Oil Report. The online news service covers business, politics, security, and yes, energy and oil in Iraq. Ben Lando is back in Kalamazoo. Today, he's here with his colleague, Ali, who is the Baghdad bureau chief. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And let's just note here that we are referring to Ali by simply the name Ali for purposes of security. So let's start off with the idea of security. Tell us, we've heard a lot about ISIS. How safe is it right now to be in Iraq?
Well, I think it really depends on where in Iraq you are. The safest places in Iraq are the furthest north and the furthest south, I think, is the general way to describe it. And that's where there's the least amount of presence of ISIS and also other terrorist outfits. There still is regular explosions in Baghdad and places immediately south of Baghdad, as well as this territory north and to the west of the country, basically about a third of the country. I would say, speaking not as an Iraqi, that's the biggest threat right now, is just this essentially a war that's being carried out, a battle that's happening. But you know, Iraqi citizens face numerous other threats, a lack of services, maybe behind schedule development of the security forces, police.
Ali, you want to pick it up from there?
Well, I think that the main areas, there are five provinces in Iraq, the three western of Iraq provinces, which is Mosul, Salahuddin, and Anbar province, and the other two, like Diyala in the east, and Kirkuk, which is, I mean, the Kurds are there and the Iraqi security forces, but it is still a threat is at the, what we say, at the doors, at there. So, I mean, in these provinces, but the risks are not just there of ISIS, because it's just spread over the other areas in the country for the plans they are doing, for they have like what we call them like sleeping cells in other parts, especially in Baghdad. Why? Because Baghdad is the capital. They would like to do as much as they can to draw the attention.
We've seen a lot about American journalists being targeted by ISIS and some of them being killed, beheaded. What is the danger for the average Iraqi citizen, if there is such a thing, when it comes to ISIS?
Well, in general, the Iraqis themselves are targeted because the ISIS main targets, you know, is to kill as much as from the civilians in general. It's not just the Westerns. So that's why we see the roadside bombs and the car bombs, on the suicide car bombs. They are targeting the massive peoples near these recently by the Shiite mosque, especially during the last few weeks, because there is a Shiite ceremony. It's called Ashura and Muharram. About five or six Shiite mosques were targeted. For both reasons, for, you know, massive people there at these areas, and also on the markets and in the other areas. So, and I mean, as an Iraqi now, how to describe to you that is the fears that we feel now is much, much more than when we, you know, the days of Qaeda in 2006 and 2007. So, because the targets are, everywhere you could expect them, even in Baghdad. And even the south is relatively safe, but there are still bombs happen mm-hmm. in some areas, you know, car bombs happen. So, I mean, in their daily lives, the Iraqis, the threats are still standing.
Beyond, I think, just the sectarian issue, which is big and it's what drives them, but in their way of thinking, anyone who isn't part of and supporting the caliphate is a viable target. The rationale is just because they are, you know, acceptable collateral damage. And I think that's what poses a big risk. And beyond that, it also leads to increased sectarianism, because then there's a lot of people who would say, well, if you're going to join the caliphate, then you must be a Sunni. And so that means everyone who's a Sunni is a suspect. And that plays out as it does in any country where there's sectarian issues or divisiveness. It's a kind of revolving action-reaction and a bloody one.
And I think the moment as an Iraqi, when ISIS came in June, the first nights there were, you know, many people were talking and the thinking in our heads that we expect that they come to our doors. Everywhere was no place safe, whether in the south or in Baghdad. Just we were thinking that it's like nightmare in the first weeks, especially in the first and the second week. People were, you know, thinking everywhere that it will be just like they continue to the south and they will take too, because they're targeting the, mostly they announced this in their statements, the ISIS. They were trying to reach Karbala, which is the Shiite holy shrine, and Najaf.
South of Baghdad.
South of Baghdad.
For someone who just simply catches the latest news report out of Iraq, and even on a news source like NPR, which probably covers it more in depth than most others, what do you think would surprise them to know about day-to-day life in Baghdad or in other parts of Iraq? Ali?
Well, the situation in Iraq, we have been in this experience for, you know, more than a decade. So the things in Iraq, unpredictable. It's very hard, you know, because it's things very complicated with each other. It is ISIS, and has been mentioned, the sectarian. The sectarian is very high. And there have been very concerns since by the Sunni leaders about the complaint in Iraq, those, you know, the Shiite volunteers, that the groups from different Shiite parties and very strongly supported, they are not within the security, officially, with the security forces. So this, I think, maybe at the any time, this is the will bring back the sectarian to its peak, like what happened in 2000. Why? Because the standing government now, the new government, Prime Minister Abadi government, there was a feeling among Iraqis that they were hoping, you know, to sort it out many things. But there have been massive, mistakes and wrong policies by the former government of Mr. Maliki. So that this cannot be cleared in 1 year or 2 years or three. This will bring economic, social, sectarian, security. So they spend billions of dollars on the security forces, but at the end, in one night, more than 65,000 Iraqi security forces escaped from Mosul in 2 hours. In 2 hours, I met one of the soldiers, those who were escaped from Mosul. He said, I finished my duty. He's nearby my area I live in now. So he said, I see a young guy in 20s, and he said, I slept in Mosul. I just slept the night after I finished my duty around 11 o'clock, 11 p.m. He said, and 3 o'clock in the morning, a colleague of mine just asked me to wake up. I said, what happened? He told me, okay, you have just to change your civilian clothes. We have to escape. What happened? He said, I was trying to say, where are our leaders? Where are our commanders? So I'm just giving this an example to see how the situation in Iraq, this is very mysterious and unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. I think people would be surprised on a number of fronts. One, just how big of a challenge the government in Iraq faces. It's massive. It's deep-rooted. It basically goes into every single aspect of running the country, because it's actually, the focus has to be correcting the mistakes of the past 10 plus years, institutional mistakes. and correcting that. I think another thing that people would be surprised about is just how close to the brink Iraq is. Iraq is in many different ways close to falling apart, breaking apart, falling apart, slipping away. And I think probably the most surprising, I don't know if that is even the right word, would be that under such, you know, long-term, seemingly hopeless prospects, you know, Iraqis get up in the morning just like we do. They, you know, they go to school. If the roads aren't blocked or there's not too much traffic to get there, they, you know, at night, you know, you'll see them at the ice cream shops. You'll see them at the restaurants. I don't want to American generalize life in Iraq, but there's a bit of reality still.
Or maybe the children go to the street right. one day and they have American baseball.
Right. One day.
Ben, at the risk of sounding perhaps a little flip here, I mean, when you mentioned that Iraq is close to the brink, mm-hmm. what would going over the brink look like? Because to the outside now, Iraq looks like a country which is, in many ways, falling apart.
Sure.
If it gets there, I mean, what would be the things that we would see that would make things even worse than they are now?
The sectarianism actually becoming permanent. I don't think it is just yet, but the sectarian being permanent and the majority of the country saying Sunni Arabs are the enemy regardless. That's a recipe for a civil war, and that breaks the country apart. That becomes an act of war between two states. The Kurdish negotiations with the central government, it could lead to a big compromise. It could lead to a compromise that says, okay, we're going to agree to the terms of the divorce, as one Kurdish official told me.
Which would mean separate countries.
Separate
at that
countries.
Point?
However, what that would most likely lead to is a actual war over the disputed territories, over oil rich territories, over Kirkuk and other territories that have sizable, if not majority, non Kurdish populations. Or vice versa, if Baghdad stakes claims on areas that are majority Kurdish, that would lead to a civil war. If that happens, or if there's some measure of further Kurdish autonomy, economic oil autonomy, then the southern provinces say, hey, we actually produce even more oil than them. Why aren't we getting the same rights? We're going to declare our independent country or our autonomy, or somehow say that our desires for the benefits for our province should actually be the governing force behind, you know, a national government. And that's just an unsustainable way of governing a country.
Well, until ISIS came in June, that, you know, many Iraqis, you know, patriotic, you know, nationals, and they say, well, we should stay one country from different parties, you know. Even the feeling among ordinary Iraqis like me and many educated people or non-educated. So they were saying, well, it's better to stay one country. We have a constitution. We have federalism. We have... But to be honest, as an Iraqi, I'm not representing now every Iraqi, but just giving my view after the experience of ISIS in Iraq in June, that I was hearing this personally and in many people, friends, and there are a lot of also sounds against this, voices against this, but I heard many people say that if now the division to have separate regions, not regions, but separate countries, if let people live safely, that would be better for us. Better than, because as Ben just mentioned, that there is no mistrust. Mistrust not just between the Kurds and the central government, mistrust between the Shiite, the Sunnis, and the Kurds. Those the main functions of Iraq. They have no trust among themselves, and they don't want, in a way or another, I just don't want to be unfair, but I think that many people now say that if we live in separate regions, in separate states, it will be safer for everybody.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Ben Lando is the founder of the Iraq Oil Report. He's also a Western Michigan University graduate and Kalamazoo native. And we've also been joined by Ali, who is the Baghdad bureau chief for the Iraq Oil Report. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.